The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia and to the Carol Phillips Memorial Lecture. I'm Andy Greenberg. I'm a former director of the Library Foundation. Carol Phillips' son, my family got involved in the library because it was a passion of my mother's, and we've been pleased to follow her good instincts. From the author's event series to its inspiring theater collection, which chronicles the rich history of American theater and early film, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity through thoughtful programming and life-changing resources. Many of the library's most beloved programs and services are made possible only with the help of people like you. Please make a gift of whatever amount you're able to support the important work of the Free Library. You can do so online at freelibrary.org. It's now my great pleasure to introduce one of our finest actresses, Angelica Houston. Winner of the Academy Award for the film Pritzi's Honor and the third generation of Oscar winners in her legendary family, Angelica Houston has forged a long and remarkably decorated career in Hollywood. Her film credits include roles in a diverse array of films, from indie cult classics to box office smashes, and her many honors include an Independent Spirit Award and a Golden Globe Award, as well as multiple Oscar, BAFTA, and Emmy awards and nominations. Angelica's new memoir, Watch Me, chronicles her turbulent, high-profile 17-year relationship with Jack Nicholson, her rise to stardom, her collaborations with the greatest directors in Hollywood, the death of her father, the legendary director John Huston, and her marriage to sculptor Robert Graham. Winking at the past through the lens of time, Huston gamely drops her mysterious veneer to reveal a vulnerable girl with a perpetually breaking heart, according to Elle magazine. Her tireless fascination with the world is thrilling. She never gets bored, and neither do we. Angelica will be interviewed tonight by Stephen Ray, the film critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the author of Hollywood Rides a Bike, Cycling with the Stars. It's truly an honor to have her here with us tonight. Please join me in welcoming Angelica Houston to the Free Library.
Welcome to Philadelphia, Angelica.
Thank you, Stephen.
It's great to have you here.
Great to be here in the rain.
Yeah, it's a cold, chilly kind of Irish Dublin evening.
It's thrilling. I'm living in California, and we haven't seen rain in like 7 years.
Thought it would be terrific if you'd like to just start off before questions with, if you wouldn't mind reading just an excerpt from the book.
Thank you. Is that okay with all of you?
This is straight from the beginning?
Yeah, mm-hmm. This is chapter one. My old life ended and my new life began. As I was standing next to a baggage carousel in the customs hall at LAX in March 1973, it was there at the age of 21 that I parted ways with Bob Richardson, the man I had lived with for the last 4 years, a bold and provocative fashion photographer 24 years older than I, with whom I'd been involved in a tempestuous affair. Until this moment, we'd been sharing an apartment in Gramercy Park, New York. Had it not been for the presence of my father and his latest wife, Cece, with whom Bob and I had just been vacationing in La Paz, Mexico, I doubt that I would ever have had the final stroke of courage it would take to leave him. I would be staying temporarily at the ranch house in the Pacific Palisades that Cece had owned prior to her marriage to Dad, and that she was redecorating to accommodate some treasures from our old life at St. Clarence, a pastoral estate in the west of Ireland where I grew up with my brother Tony, before we moved with our mother to London, before the birth of my half-siblings, Danny and Allegra, before I acted in a movie at the age of 16 with my father directing, before my mother's death by car crash in 1969, a cataclysmic experience that for me ended that beautiful, hopeful decade when I moved from England to America. One morning, early in my stay at Cece's, I ordered a taxi and told the driver to take me to Hollywood. "Do you mean Vine Street?" he asked vaguely. I had guessed that Hollywood wasn't really a place, but rather a state of mind, with a great many parking lots sandwiched between shops and storefronts advertising sex and liquor. But oddly, there was a sense of coming home to California. Although I'd grown up in Europe, I was born in Los Angeles. The desert skies were clear blue and untroubled. Living with my father again felt strange, but he would be leaving soon to resume work on the Macintosh Man in New York. I was eager to buy some Marabou bedroom stilettos to match the pink swan's down trimmed negligee that Cece had generously just given me. Driving along Sunset in the pale sunshine, I noticed that the panorama was bare and garish, mostly warehouses and two-story facades. There were rows of tall palm trees and purple jacarandas. The air was windy and dry and sweet-scented. Beverly Hills, it seemed, was all about who you were, what you were driving, your pastimes, and your playgrounds. A few days before, Cece had taken me shopping on Rodeo Drive, where there was a yellow-striped awning above Giorgio's boutique with outdoor atomizers that puffed their signature Giorgio perfume. Indulgent husbands drank espresso at a shiny brass bar inside as their wives shopped for feathered gowns and beaded cocktail dresses. For lingerie, the local sirens went to Jewel Park, who was known to seal the deal for many aspirants based on the strength of her hand-stitched negligees and satin underwear trimmed with French lace. We lunched at the Luau, a Polynesian watering hole, the darkest oasis on the street where you could hear rummy confessions from the next-door booth as you tucked behind your ear a fresh gardenia from the scorpion punch. Los Angeles was a small town then. It felt both incredibly glamorous and a little provincial. Cece, who was in her late 30s, had a son, Colin, by a former marriage to the documentary filmmaker and screenwriter Waylon Green. Cece had gone to private schools in Beverly Hills and Montecito, and her friends were the hot beauties of the day, from Jill St. John and Stephanie Powers to Bo Derek and Stephanie Zimbalist. Glamorous sportswomen and great horseback riders who'd grown up privileged in the Western Sun Belt. She'd played baseball with Elvis Presley at Beverly Glen Park in the 50s and roomed with Grace Slick at Finch College in New York. Cece had also a lively retinue of gay friends who were sportive and gossipy and informal. Cece's energy was buoyant. She cursed like a sailor and loved a bit of illicit fun, as did I. Our practice, at least a couple of times a week, was to do an impromptu raid on other people's gardens in the neighboring canyons. I would wield the shears, and with a trunk full of flowers and branches, Cece would drive her candy apple red Maserati like a getaway car, burning rubble to peals of laughter. Although we tempted fate for some miraculous reason, we never got caught. Sometimes Allegra would accompany us on these forays. After the sale of St. Clarence, Allegra had moved in with her Irish nanny, Kathleen Shine, whom we called Nurse, to share a rented house in Santa Monica with Gladys Hill, Dad's co-writer and secretary. Heartbroken by the death of our mother and still painfully loyal to her, Nurse had been a staple of Tony's and my childhood. Gladys was calm, deliberate, intelligent, and kind. A pale-complexioned woman with ice-blonde hair from West Virginia, she was devoted to Dad and shared his passion for pre-Columbian art. She'd worked for him the previous decade and was part of the family in Ireland when I was growing up. Allegra was going on 9 and was extremely smart. It was already her intention to go to Oxford University. From the time she was a baby, she'd had an innate, deep wisdom and a sweet formality about her. I looked up Jeremy Railton, a handsome Rhodesian friend from my former life when I was going to school in London. He'd been designing the sets for a play by Nozaki Shange for colored girls who've considered suicide when the rainbow is enough, and was living in an apartment on Fountain Avenue. We picked up our friendship where we'd left off 5 years before. He introduced me to his social circle, which included the comedy writer Kenny Soames and his collaborator Gail Parent, the talent agent Sandy Gallen, Michael Douglas and Brenda Vaccaro, Paula and Lisa Weinstein, and Neil Diamond. Kenny and Gail wrote for The Carol Burnett Show and had numerous television specials with Mary Tyler Moore, Dick Van Dyke, and Julie Andrews. Cece knew that I was still shaken from my split with Bob Richardson. She did her best to take me out and introduce me to people, but I was more interested in riding her horses and walking in the next door garden. She and Dad had just celebrated the completion of a new jacuzzi, and one afternoon I found the actor Don Johnson and a male friend of his floating in it. Although I was grateful to Cece for her efforts, I was somewhat embarrassed and ran back to the camellia trees. A Swedish friend of hers, Brigida, who owned Strip Thrills, a dress shop on Sunset, told Cece that she was going to a party at Jack Nicholson's house that evening and invited her to come along. Cece asked if she could bring her stepdaughter, and Brigida said fine, that it was his birthday and Jack loved pretty girls. I borrowed an evening dress from Cece, black, long, open at the back with a diamante clasp. Brigida and another Swedish girl picked us up, and the four of us drove in Brigida's car to Jack's house on Mulholland Drive, on a high ridge separating Beverly Hills from the San Fernando Valley on the other side. It felt like we were on top of the world. The front door of a modest two-story ranch-style house opened, and there was that smile. Later, after he became a superstar and was on the cover of Time magazine, Diana Vreeland was to christen it the killer smile. But at that time, I thought, ah, yes, now there's a man you could fall for. Mm.
And indeed, you did fall.
Yes.
I was curious that writing the first memoir and now the second, whether the process was different for you, the experience. Childhood memories and adolescent memories are sort of, obviously chronologically they're further back, but they're sort of formative. And when you were, this book, as you started reading, telling us, it starts when you were 21. Was it, and we've accumulated more experience, there's more stuff in our head, was it easier or more difficult or different to process this second?
Well, thinking about it, I was a bit concerned, obviously, because this book involves my life in Hollywood and meeting a lot of people who are still alive. Mm-hmm. Most of the people that I wrote about in my first book, sadly, have moved on to another plane. So as I was thinking about it, that seemed to pose a bit of a problem. However, I kind of wrote the first and the second book initially in a bit of a chunk. It was my editor's decision to split them. So I'd already written quite a good deal on Watch Me. But, of course, when you go back, you see that you have to pretty much go back from the beginning. So although I had some raw material for book two, I really had to go back and start from the beginning on it. For me, you know, apart from, and I didn't really have a lot of difficulty when it came to describing people and places. I have a good memory for that. But to to be accurate about people and not to either take advantage of them or betray them. Those things initially concerned me, but I found that in the writing, it's almost like dealing with your friends, you know? If you have good feelings about people, good things come out. Mm-hmm. And generally, I have good feelings about people.
There's also you have, as we just heard, you have this wonderful talent for writing, for telling stories, and for making scenes vivid and people vivid. And do you where do you think that came from? Do you think, I mean, you came from a father, your father obviously was a great master storyteller, yeah. And your mother wrote.
My mother was a great storyteller too, and a writer. And I think because I grew up in the land of stories, I grew up in Ireland. Everything's a story in Ireland, you know. You say, oh, you know, how do I get to the next village? They say, where are you coming from? And a story emerges. So that was sort of my landscape.
Mm-hmm. As you describe through the book, your relationship with Jack Nicholson in 17 years, there's ups and downs to it, obviously. And you describe early on when he was about to shoot The Passenger, the Antonioni film in North Africa and in Spain, how he was this totally unpretentious actor, but when he started to assume the character he was playing in that film, he became someone different to you. And that was a fascinating insight, not only in Jack Nicholson's process, but the process that you go through and most actors go through when they're undertaking a role. And then does it make it harder to have a relationship with someone who's constantly changing
a different
character?
Person? Yeah. Well, yes, it can be kind of surprising. I remember when Jack was on The Shining and...
Did he come at you with an axe?
Oh, my God. No. Well, first of all, he was just... dogged at the end of the day because he loves Stanley Kubrick, but Stanley beat the hell out of him. And Jack would come staggering. We were living on the embankment in London on Cheyne Walk in this very strange house, which had actually been a halfway house during the Black Plague, appropriately, and had poltergeist. I swear, ashtrays would launch themselves across the rooms of this house, and Jack would come back, stagger in the door after work, you know, at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, still with the blood clot in his head, you know, the sugar blood. It wasn't pretty. Yeah, it is. It's very weird being with an actor, particularly a consummate actor. And then all of a sudden, you know, he'll be making Preetzi's Honor and you'll know, oh, good morning, how are you? Are you okay? You know. It's like living with a chameleon. Mm. But then, you know, I do it too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of Preetzi's Honor, do you look at that now as sort of a breakthrough film for you in terms of...
Yeah, mm-hmm. I do.
Because you talk about it comes across in the early chapters of the book how you really you were challenged. You didn't have a sense of confidence about yourself as an actor. You modeled and then you got parts. But you correct me if I'm wrong. But you felt sort of that the parts that you got in those early films had to do with nepotism and who you knew, and you weren't really being valued for your own, who you were and your abilities and talents. Is that?
Yeah, it wasn't going sort of quite the way I'd pictured it. Mm-hmm. And I'd wanted to be an actress since I was a small child. I knew what my father did. I was on movie sets. I liked the actresses a lot. I thought they were great. That was what I wanted to be. But Sorry, I've lost track of the question. You'll forgive me. I'm a bit gaga from book tourism.
No, sure. Well, I was wondering whether Prizzi's honor for which you won
Was it breakthrough?
Sort of a breakthrough.
How did it come? Yeah. I'd made a film with my father when I was 16 called A Walk with Love and Death. And that was very difficult because I was going to school in London and there was a school search for Franco Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet. And I really wanted to be Juliet. And my father had decided that he was going to give me this sort of wonderful present and put me in a movie, star me in a movie. But it wasn't the movie that I was attracted to. It wasn't a part that I was attracted to. And, you know, I was too good to work with him. I wanted to work with, Franco Zeffirelli in Rome. I didn't want to go to Austria with Dad. And so, you know, and I was 16. Mm-hmm. And so I think we made each other's life a misery. And after that, I came back to London. My mother was killed very suddenly in a car crash. I decided not to go back to school at that point. I think I had some private tutoring. I got some A-levels, but school and I were not really destined to love each other. And then Tony Richardson offered me a part, or offered me to understudy Marianne Faithfull in Hamlet, which he was doing at the Roundhouse with Nicol Williamson. And so that was kind of my way out of England. It was going on tour to America, and so I kind of jumped ship and flew to New York and started a new life. But it's true, I didn't want to get back into movies for quite some time, and didn't for at least 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm. How many times did you get to perform Hamlet? Did Marianne Faithfull ever take like a sick day or?
Oh yeah, she did. She was an understudy's dream. Except for the times where, you know, I'd be all dressed up in her costume, ready to go with her wig on my head, because in those days, you know, they had one wig for the main character and the understudy, and she'd come in. She was a great Ophelia, by the way. Perfect casting. And I'd have to take off the wig. And I don't know, you know, she was about 5'1", and I was as tall as I am. I wore her dress. I don't know how that worked. Yeah, but anyway, yes, she was, and I liked her too. We had fun.
Are there films that stand out for you? Films that you were in, that you were involved in, that hold a special place in your heart, either for the character you played or the experience of making it.
Well, certainly Prizzi's was huge for me because it was sort of the opposite of my early experience with my dad. This time I was all ready and prepared, and I'd been with the acting teacher Peggy Fury for a number of years, so I was confident. Mm-hmm. I knew how to set up a background for my character. I was much more in charge of what I was doing. So it was a very good movie for me. And I think another good movie for me was The Witches, a Nick Rogue movie. Mm-hmm.
Based on the Roald Dahl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Adam's Family, of course. Mm-hmm. The Grifters.
Mm-hmm. Well, The Grifters is chilling. You talk about how the relationship you had with John Cusack, who plays your son in the film, that there was the... I don't want to misquote you, but you sort of, there was a sexual dynamic going on there.
Yeah.
And then you have...
you know.
And then you have that the final scene, or close to the final scene in the film, when you basically seduce him. You're trying to seduce your son to get the money, and then things go really bad.
Horrible accident happens. Yeah. It's a good advice for mothers. Don't seduce your sons. Try not.
Now, Now, you've also directed, and your description of the the first film you directed is sort of amusing, because here you are already this seasoned veteran actress, and you're waiting for them to come and call you for the trailer, and no one comes. And
I'm sitting there. I've gotten there nice and early, and I think I better be prepared. And also, my husband said, you know, Angelica, you're going to direct a movie. You have to put on makeup every day. Fresh white shirt, makeup, do your hair. Don't let anyone see you, you know, fraying or falling apart. You have to go in strong. So so there I am, and I'm thinking, yeah, that's good, and I should have a strong breakfast. So I order bacon and eggs, and then I'm waiting around in my trailer, like, nobody comes, and I think, well, you know, maybe I'll amble down to the set and find out what's happening. So I go down to the set, and I meet the assistant director, and she goes, I went, she goes, the director's the first person on the set. We don't call the director. I was so embarrassed. It was awful. But at least everyone knew I was pathetic at that point. Can you imagine? I was, how many movies had I made at that point?
Right. And then you, with Bastard Out of Carolina, the film that you're directing, you had trouble getting people to see that film because was Ted Turner produced it, and it was
well, it was a difficult situation because it was a movie. That originally had been set up at Turner with actually another female director, and my agent knew that I wanted to direct, and when the other director fell out, I had to make my decision in a couple of days. And I read the thing over the weekend and loved it. I thought, wow, that's really amazing that this thing is dropping in my lap, and I signed on. And it was, it kind of came out of the blue. For me, it was a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm jumping around a bit, but I was just thinking of your description of working with Wes Anderson and on the Royal Tannenbaums with Gene Hackman, and how you, there's a scene where you slap Gene Hackman, and you sort of approach that scene with Jed, and in fact, slapped him. It wasn't a fake slap, right?
No, it wasn't. And you can't fake slap, you know, it's a close-up. And or actually, it wasn't a close-up. It was just all in one. It's this scene where he says, I have cancer, and I fall apart. It's horrible. I'm his ex-wife, or about to be ex-wife. And then he says, no, I don't mean it. I don't have cancer. So I haul off and whap him in the face. That says the scene is written. And of course, it was an early morning in January, and I had kid gloves. And for the first couple of rehearsals, I batted him on the lapel. And I don't know that he was expecting the real haul off. I whapped him, and this red welt came up on his cheek. God damn. I was pretty scared. I was hoping Wes wouldn't make us go again, but I did it so good that we didn't have to.
One take.
One take.
Yeah. You also say that he was much tougher on men than on women, Gene Hackman.
Oh, he's tough on Wes, yeah.
Yeah, didn't he say, pull up your pants
and
stop
act like a man. Yeah. It was terrible. This was a scene in which Royal Tannenbaum, the Gene Hackman character, was in an upstairs bedroom, and Wes, whose brother is a very talented artist, was trying to line up a shot in which you could see the cartoons that the brother had, you know, who was also the set designer, had drawn on the wall of this bedroom. And Gene got really mad at Wes. You're just lining me up so you can show your brother's art. And, you know, Wes, you could see the blood rising in his cheeks. And I'm like, no, you know. And then Hackman stomped off the stage, and Wes went running after him. And we had this little green room, you know, on the second floor, and you could hear doors slamming. And it was freezing cold winter, so we're all packed into this tiny set. I got really scared. I went down to kind of save Wes, but Wes looked after himself. He's actually real strong. He just looks wimpy.
And then of course, you've made other films with Wes Anderson, The Life Aquatic.
Yeah, I love working with Wes. Mm-hmm. He always pulls you out to some crazy remote location and makes you get really precise about dialogue. But he's wonderful, and he's got such a fantastic imagination, and he's a delightful person.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've worked with Clint Eastwood, too, in Blood Work, where he directed the film and stars in it as a retired FBI agent, and you're his doctor.
Yeah, he kept saying, beat me up, beat me up. Like, how can I do that? And then I'd be standing behind he was playing a heart patient, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I'm his cardiologist, and I'd be standing behind his bed on the set, and he'd look at just like my dad, you know, when my dad was sick. So I'd be half broken up, and then having to beat him up, and then he's also directing the film, and he has this very particular style, which is half the time the camera's rolling through rehearsal. So he just catches this and that as it goes on. He doesn't really tell you he's shooting the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then he'll come over and you think, oh, he's going to give me some really good direction. He'll say, we're going to have steak and lobster for lunch. Okay. That's good. I love Clint. He's crazy. That chair thing he did, that's so Clint, you know.
Another director you've worked with on several occasions is Woody Allen, and he's famous.
That's another, that's another barrel of fish.
Yeah. I mean, he's sort of famously taciturn or reticent with actors.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Did he give you any direction at all in Crimes and Misdemeanors? And
he wrote me this really charming letter saying, you know, you get murdered in this movie. Like, how could I resist? And so, of course, I was so excited to work with him. And I was just passing through New York. I'd done a movie called Enemies, a Love Story in Canada with the great Paul Mazursky. Mm. And I was coming back through New York, and I was going to work with Woody in about 3 weeks. I was going back to L.A. first. But since I was in New York, I thought, well, it'll be okay if I call his office and find out if he wants to meet. And so I call his office, somebody answers, and I said, you know, is Woody there? No, of course he wasn't there, but could he call me back? And so I hung around for an hour or so, and he called me back, and I said, I'm in town. I just thought maybe, you know, since I'm here, you'd like to have a drink or a coffee or something. It'd be nice to meet you. And he went, yeah, that would be okay. There was a long pause, but I'm sick. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry you're sick. Well, you know, maybe some other time, maybe in a couple of days or something before I go. I'm here for 3 days or so. And he goes, well, what if I'm sick then? I went, oh, that'll really be terrible. Anyway, I didn't see him at all before I went to work. And all through the costume fittings, I never saw him. And my first day's work was really tough because I had to, you know, beat up on Marty Landau and scream at him and take pills and drink and be alcoholic and frenzied, and of course, I didn't meet Woody until I walk up on the set, and it was a night like tonight, rainy and hot and humid inside this apartment building, and I had to storm around, and he didn't give me any direction at all, And he just let us go on and on and on, take after take in this scene. I thought, oh God, this is a nightmare. But then he seemed perfectly happy. And that was that. he did the whole thing in one shot. So every time I'm not on camera, I'm fumbling over arc lights in other rooms because it was set up like an obstacle course, this set. It was funny.
Well, he asked you back to do another film.
Yeah, he did.
Manhattan Murder Mystery.
Yeah, Manhattan Murder Mystery, where he makes me look really intelligent and gives me things like, you know, I get to be a card shark, but in actual fact, he's doing all this stuff with the cards. He's so fantastic. He's such an amazingly incredible comedian. Mm.
Your relationship with Jack Nicholson, as you describe it in the book, it's there's often times where it's a struggle for you emotionally, and you describe a scene when you're visiting him in Montana when he's shooting Missouri Breaks, and you find some love letters that were written by a young woman to Jack, and he tells you, oh no, they were actually for Harry Dean Stanton.
That's right. Yeah. Okay.
Right. And you write, for a sophisticated girl, I could be tragically gullible. Maybe that's why acting has always appealed to me. If I want to, I can believe almost anything.
It's true.
And I think that's really telling, that a part of being an actor and being a good actor is being open to believing the character you are and the characters your fellow actors are playing. So that's not just sort of a... it's a heart-rending moment that you describe, but it's also an insight into what you do and the craft of acting.
I'd have to agree. you have to know what it feels like, and frankly, sometimes it's a big responsibility. Like, you don't go into a movie like Enemies, a Love Story, albeit a comedy from Isaac Bashevis Singer, mm-hmm. without accepting the responsibility for the hundreds of thousands of people who were murdered in concentration camps. This woman's children were murdered. That's a heavy responsibility. And if you don't believe it, you have no right to portray it. You have to hold that stuff inside yourself. And yes, you have to believe it. Mm-hmm. And believe it, I do.
We're going to open the questions up to the audience, but I just have one other question before we do, which is there are these wonderfully vivid scenes in the book of you in motion, whether it's early on where you're David Bailey is shooting, you're on an Italian auto route, and he's leaning out of a car with his camera. This is when you're still modeling.
I was thinking.
And you're on a motorcycle in a Missoni outfit. And then you're riding horses when you first come to L.A. and riding horses again in a number of your films, Lonesome Dove and in Ever After. And I get this sense from the book that you're almost constantly in motion one way or another. And does it feel like sort of a whirlwind to you?
Yeah, life goes fast, doesn't it? I do see myself in motion, although it's hard for me to fly. I don't like it much. I like to be
fly
more...
in a jet, you mean in a plane, as opposed to just, yeah.
Well, I try that once in a while, too. I like to be in motion, and I like to be going places, but particularly on horseback, because for those of you who ride horses, you know what I'm talking about. But it's a level of perception, and it's kind of like being a giant riding on a horse. You know, there's a magnanimous feel to it. It's great, And when you're really at one with a horse, it's a perfect feeling. It's just, you know, they move as part of you, you move as part of them. It's a beautiful union. I see a lovely dog there. Mm. Mm. They make me happy too. He's very welcome. Mm.
You were saying before that you were on a horse before you learned to walk. Your father put you on a horse.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was an avid rider, and he loved to hunt. He'd come back from locations, you know, and just get right up on a horse. Even in his 70s, he was wild.
Mm. Okay, well, let's open up for questions. If you can just wait for the microphone to come to you, and then we can go from there. The woman raising the hand in the fifth aisle on the left there.
Hello.
Hi.
I thought that The Dead was a magnificent movie, and that you were just so fine in that. Could you talk a little bit about filming that? That was your father's last direction, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
The Dead we made in a warehouse in Valencia, which is the home of Magic Mountain, and in the day wasn't a place where film studios existed. Now it's kind of, I think they do a lot of television productions there now. But it was great because the company secured it for this group of actors, mostly from the Abbey Theater, who had been cast on tape and come over to work for Dad in arguably the best short story ever written by James Joyce. Mm. And we were all together in this space. It was very intimate. And a really sort of more like doing a play than making a movie in some ways. We shot consistently and what's that word? Consistent, you know,
in sequence.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And it was a very moving film to make because Dad was not well. He was in a wheelchair and on oxygen at the time. And so we were all pretty worried about him. He didn't miss a day. He didn't miss a beat. He was as acute and precise as he's ever been. And, you know, later when she saw the movie, the critic Pauline Kael said it looked easier to Dad than to watch, you know, to watch this film. To have it seemed that it was easier for him to make this film than breathing. Mm. And I think that's absolutely true. The movie is kind of seamless. And I remember his saying, you know, I wonder what people will think of a film where the most sort of active moment is the breaking of a wishbone. But it's so fine, and you think, what is this about? It's not really about anything, and then it's about everything in this last scene. And so it was a hard film to make for me because we were shooting, as I say, in sequence, and this big scene was looming at the end of the shoot, and so I was kind of nervous all the way through till we got to that scene. And it was fun, though. It was good when we got around to it.
It was a family affair, too. Didn't your brother write
the
adaptation?
Yeah, my brother wrote the screenplay. Yeah. Yeah.
Another question? It's in the sixth row in the center.
Hi, Miss Houston. We love you.
Oh, you're lovely. Thank you.
Yes. We saw that People magazine reported today that you asked Jack Nicholson to marry you. You dared him to. And
yeah.
And he said no.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
What was wrong with him? Right?
It was kind of early on in our relationship, and I was trailing after him to go to Laker games, which I mean, they've had their moments, I know, and everything, but they weren't having a moment then. They were losing like a blue streak, and he also liked going to like college games, UCLA games, and stuff, and I don't know. We had to go to North Carolina to see UCLA lose miserably. And we were in some motel, you know, one of those places where they have ice machines in the halls. And we were watching television. It was The Marriage Game. And he said, "Ooh, whittle marriage." And I said, "What's wrong with marriage?" He went, "Marriage, marriage." And I said, "If you had any balls, you'd marry me." And he went, "Marry you? Are you kidding?" That was it. I cried for 3 days. I cried all the way back to Los Angeles, you know, for 2 days after that. But, you know, I don't think he meant it in a negative way. But then he asked me later on, and I got to say no.
Here in the fourth row in the center section.
Hi, are there any roles that you regret that you didn't take?
Well, I kind of regret that I didn't take Kathy Bates's role in Misery, which was offered to me first, because she got the Academy Award for it. When in truth, I had the better role in The Grifters. They just didn't give it to me. But those two movies were made simultaneously, so I preferred the movie I was in. Thank you.
I couldn't see anyone else as that role in The Grifters.
No, just yeah.
You.
Thank you. That crazy blonde broad.
Yeah, you have that great blonde movie. Just over there.
Hi. Thank you so much for coming to Philadelphia and sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
I feel like just your presence is so overwhelming. As I'm growing, I'm beginning to learn that I learn more from my failures in life than I do from my successes. So looking back, what do you think was your greatest failure, and what did you learn from it?
Nice way of easing into that tough question.
I know. Really good presentation. My biggest failure. Well, I think probably was, it's always been about contact, or, you know, being too shy to tell people how I really feel or what I really think. And I think, you know, if I'd been more honest with my father around A Walk with Love and Death, if I'd said to him, or had the presence of mind to say to him instead of everybody else, "I don't like this part. I don't think this part is good for me. Let's do something else." But, you know, when you're a kid and, you know, you're full of defenses, that's the thing I think that sometimes I'm reticent about. I don't say what I really feel because I think I'm going to hurt the person, or I get scared. And I find the more that I have courage, the better things are. But it's taken me a hell of a long time to, you know, get straight with that.
I really loved Smash when it was on.
Thank you.
What made you choose to take that part, and what was it like making that show?
Well, there's a piece in the book about having gone to do the pilot on Smash and then coming back to Los Angeles and thinking, God, I'm signing up for something for 6 years at least. And I'd never done that in my life before. You know, movie's finite, and you think, well, after this, I'll go to Cancun or whatever. But 6 years, that's a long time for me to commit to something. So I went to see my friend, the agent Sue Mengers, who was a wonderful woman and gave me great advice all the way along. And I said, "Sue, I'm worried. You know, I'm really trepidatious about this. And 6 years, and how am I going to hack it? And it's New York. I'm not even at home. And
She said, "It's a fucking miracle."
So I went off to do Smash, and the first year was really great. I was kind of scared, but it was good. And thank God for the book, because on a show like that, you know, a character works maybe intensely 3-4 days a week, from 4 o'clock in the morning until late at night. But then the other days are kind of empty and weird. So on those other days, I had the book to write. And so I was able to keep myself pretty much on track. But second year, things started to get a bit rocky. Teresa Rebeck left the scene, and I thought she was such a good writer, and I really liked my scenes. When she was working on the show, she was also our showrunner. But after she left, I thought the material, just the scenes weren't there anymore for me anyway. It was a bit disappointing. But I agree with you. I thought it had really excellent potential, and I could have stayed with it. I could have stuck with it.
See, over here on the right side, right there, yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been wondering about the extrovert work of being an actress and the internal work of being a writer, and how you balance that.
Well, I think actually they're very close disciplines. Yes, there is the extrovert part of being an actor, but there's also, you know, that all has to happen inside first. And so I think maybe the end result looks different, but I think both disciplines require channeling, require that you put yourself in that place, whether it's a place in which you existed 20 years ago or whether it's a fantasy about who you are as another character. But I think it all starts inside. Thank you.
I just want to say your body of work is amazing. I loved Crimes and Misdemeanors, and anything and everything you've been in. But what really sticks in my head is Witches. My son is 28 years old, and 2 years ago, I bought him a copy. I bought him a DVD, The Witches, because he had seen it when he was a little boy. Terrified him. So I thought, at 28, buying the movie, we can see it together now and laugh. He still will not watch that movie. You scared him so much. So I bought your book, and I'm going to be giving it to him.
Excellent.
And
that'll scare him for sure.
And I want you to autograph it to him. Okay. On another note, when you were doing the movies with Raul Julia, how was your working relationship with him? That was such a tragedy when he died so young.
It was. I loved Raul. Raul he just changed the atmosphere on set the moment he walked on in the morning. He sang opera. He played with the kids. He was such a joyful and joyous personality. You know, he shared with everyone. He was incredibly sweet and gregarious and lovely. And I never heard him complain once. In the second Addams Family, Addams Family Values, he had, I think he probably knew that he had stomach cancer. And yet, we did tango rehearsals. It was a very physical part. He never complained. He never missed a day. He was a really beautiful man, beautiful, kind, honest, genuine man.
Hmm. Just out of curiosity, how was it like to work with Seth Rogen for 50-50?
It was good.
And being the mom of a cancer patient.
Yeah. I like that film a lot. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really well directed. Jonathan Levine is a good director. It was great. I didn't really have scenes with Seth. I like that. I like that character too, because she's just tough. She's standing there for him, and she's going to be there.
Speaking of scaring kids and the witches, also in the Addams Family, there's that great scene where you're telling the story to the kindergartners, and
they'll scream,
and they're all crying and screaming by the end.
Yeah,
Morticia.
I like. There's nothing like scaring children when they're really young. And sometimes, like, you know, you can be on a train or getting out of a car on a street or something, and some child look at you, and I know it's a little witches fan or not.
You've mentioned a number of names of people with whom we're familiar, with whom you worked, all of whom were wonderful, likable, talented. Were there any less likable, less talented, less wonderful?
Oh, very few. But yeah, of course, but, you know, I don't want to talk about them too much. But they are in the book. Well, I haven't gotten really the chance to sit down and hash it over with him. But I saw him at a party this summer in the Hamptons, and he said, "It's good." And I was just about to start, you know, peppering him with questions when dinner was called, disappointingly. So I'll tackle him on it when I get home. But I sent it to him before it went to publication because, you know, if there was anything he really hated, I'd have taken it out. But he was very sanguine.
Watching you in person, you're incredibly sweet, and you have this sense of wonder, and I wonder how you've kept that in such a tough industry.
Thank you. A nice compliment. I don't know. I had a really sweet mother, and I had a really sweet father, too, actually. And I think the older I get, the more important it is to me to that we all get along, you know? It's a tough world, and I think, you know, I think it's nice to be good to each other and nice to be kind to each other, and I don't see that there's a lot of good in anything else, you know? This is our lot. And so I just sort of see myself as part of that and try to spread goodwill and you know, keep smiling and keep laughing and, you know, hopefully. I think it's true, when you smile, the world smiles with you. I don't know if you cry and cry alone, but I think we have to make the effort, don't we? Yeah.
Oh, well, terrific. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you, Stephen, very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.